This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Last week we agreed that Chelsea were better than Spurs and it turns out we were right. No surprise to anyone as Tuchel's men make it to the final of the Carabao Cup with very little alarm. Conte's selection was odd. Was that team to let Daniel Levy know he needs a new goalkeeper, centre-backs, wing-backs, midfielders and attackers? Also today, the Jared Bowen show. Every highlight was him scoring, not quite scoring, having goals disallowed. He probably tipped the one Norwich shot onto the post. Was anyone else actually playing? Big question from AFCON. To blow early for full-time once may be regarded as a misfortune. To blow twice looks like carelessness. There's a Premier League preview. Just how many times do you sue a day? And we talk about homophobia at football and the Retire the Chant campaign. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nick Ames, welcome.
Hello, Max.
How are you?
I'm really well. I've just had a nice bowl of granola and Greek yogurt and banana, which you've just heard me eat before we began.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully for the tape, none of that sound carries over to the listeners. But Barry, you particularly enjoyed 5 minutes, you know, before getting in the zone for the pod, you know, really like teeing us up was just Nick Ames munching.
Well, I did say it sounded like he was having a bowl of pork scratchings for breakfast. That's how noisy it was coming through my headphones. But a man has to eat.
To which Chris Powross said, "Is that your breakfast of choice, Barry?" Which is a question that I suspect most listeners also thought. Chris, welcome.
Hello, hello.
And Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, hello.
Hello, mate.
So, Chris, we've got you to talk about Spurs-Chelsea and we want to talk about the Retire the Chant campaign as well. You were at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It's sort of normal, I guess, to start with the winners and talk about how good they are. But I'm happy to start with the losers. And how was that for you?
Were they that good or did we just gift them a bunch of goals and actually not really kind of come to the races? I'm kind of the view that we've all seen the Rocky films. We know what it's like when a lumbering heavyweight is trying to get back to fitness. We've got a really good trainer. We've been out of shape for a while. And like all good Hollywood arcs, there are moments when the training flounders. And maybe that was last night. Maybe Gallini
How long is this film going to be? It's going to be longer than The Irishman, the Tottenham Hotspur film, if it ends with success, isn't it?
Well, that's the hope. I mean, you know, Pochettino, 3 years ago said it was a painful rebuild. It's been painful. And we haven't even started. We actually haven't even started. So that's what this looks like. Look, we did gift them a bunch of goals. Look, Chelsea are a better side than us, and Conte said that himself. You know, we're not in their league. However, you could look at it and say, look, I'm not going to be a Pollyanna about it, except I am. We had the same number of shots on goal as them last night. We had the ball in the net. We had two, if it wasn't for VAR, and there wasn't VAR earlier in this competition, was there? We would have had two penalties. And we gifted them three goals. So there is an alternative reality in which it's not that bad.
That no one else is in. Jordan, how what do you make of that alternate reality?
I mean, I love it because, as an Arsenal fan, I'm more than happy for Spurs to stay in this alternate reality where it's just a kind of cycle of them being losers and promising much and delivering very little.
I never said we were losers.
Sorry, I'll say that then, very happily. I do agree with Christo in the sense that I don't think Chelsea of the two legs had to be particularly amazing. Yesterday in the post-match interview, Tuchel was saying, oh, in phases of both legs, we had to suffer. No, he didn't. No, they didn't. That's an absolute lie. It's, at no point did Chelsea have to suffer. There were phases of play where maybe Spurs had, you know, the ball and were attacking and threatened to score a goal. But I didn't think that was true at all. I thought this was very convincing over the two legs. I think you normally think after a 2-0 first leg, all right, if Spurs can get the first goal, they're back in it. I didn't think that here. I always thought after the first leg, Chelsea were going to win this tie. And I think it's another opportunity missed to get to a final and lose it for Spurs. So, you know, it's another trophy that they won't be winning. I think the bigger issue for Tottenham is is the transfer window. You've got the best, one of the best managers in world football in. He needs back in. We know that he likes to be backed. He's very demanding. If Spurs don't get top four, I wouldn't be surprised if we see Conte rock up at United next season, because he wants to be competitive. And I think Spurs have to really back him, because they're never going to get a manager as good as Antonio Conte. So it's for me now or never for them.
Can I just say one thing? He is a great manager. He's not going to go to Manchester United. And the only thing I will say is that he cares much less about cups than he does about the league. So actually, Jordan, let's just wait and see what happens on Sunday, shall we?
So what's he doing at Spurs? It's probably the right question, isn't it? Barry, I mean, the gulf between these two sides has looked enormous over these two legs. I've actually found it quite difficult to highlight any Chelsea players who I thought were particularly good. I just thought every one of their players was better pretty much than every Tottenham player. I guess you could say Rudiger had he scored the goal, kept Kane in his pocket, looked very good.
Yeah, he was outstanding, although he did concede one of the non-penalties. I didn't think Chelsea really had to come out of gear or second gear last night. They had a lot more left in the tank if required, I suspect. And it was telling that Thomas Tuchel was quite angry with his players after the game. He said they made too many mistakes, they lost focus, and they were only operating on 80%, and that's not good enough. So these are the standards he demands. They did more than enough to get through comfortably. And apart from one five-minute period in the second half when Spurs briefly sparked into life, Tottenham offered incredibly little.
Nick, I just wonder what I wonder if out of that Chelsea side, are they all performing at a very high level, or is it just Spurs aren't very good? I just thought Kovacic started to look really sort of consistently excellent, and we're not that interested in him because he's not a new signing. Jorginho as well. Sort of players all over the pitch who are really performing.
Yeah, that's what Tuchel has done to them, isn't it? Over the past year or so, he's turned players who were patchy, sometimes patchy at best, into sort of elite Champions League performers, and maybe the players that they always were coming through, especially Kovacic, who had a fantastic pedigree when he arrived and had been quite up and down. And Jorginho obviously has been one of the best midfielders in the world in the last year comfortably. But last night it was obviously, I wasn't at or watching the whole game because I was at West Ham, but it did seem to me like quite a patchy Spurs team, a bit of a patched up affair, catching Spurs at a bit of a delicate ebb after what happened against Morecambe at the weekend and getting booed off at half time. And I think Chelsea were entitled to strut into that game and to, display their feathers a bit and perform with confidence and a bit of arrogance. And I think from what I've seen of the game, they did it. And Spurs, it's a difficult week for Spurs now. They've got a similar week to Arsenal in that it's been two big cup games and then a massive North London derby, which is critical for both clubs on Sunday. And you would have to say that Spurs are really wobbling going into that. It's not the preparation that you would want. You've also got the Tanguy and Ndombele situation, of course. I don't think he was even on the bench yesterday, I think I'm right in saying, after he slunk off at the weekend. And there's a lot of... and you've got Son's injury, by the way, as well. So you've got... I think where Spurs are concerned... I mean, Chelsea were very good, but it's more about Spurs and their raft of unanswered questions for me coming out of this one and throwing it forward to the weekend.
Your TVZ has one of those unanswered questions, which is Kane getting no service and so looks poor? Or is Kane poor and not getting into positions to get service? Was he just a five-season wonder all along? Chris?
He's definitely not getting any service, but he's also, I think, his form isn't as it was. Because when he does have, all of, from before this season, he's been in positions, in ones that he's been in now, where he'd turn and he would always hit the target. And he's not hitting the target every single time. You'd bet, you'd have bet so much money on him hitting the target or at least being there or thereabouts, and he's just not this season. So I think it's a little bit of both, which again is all part of what some of these problems are. And I think exactly what Nick's just said as well, I think Sonny's injury is a big deal for Kane as well, and I think he might have been playing on an injury for a bit, which is why he hasn't quite been at the races the last few games either, Sonny, that is.
Jordan, as an Arsenal fan, you must be absolutely... I would be licking my lips if I was an Arsenal fan ahead of this North London derby.
Well, I would if we wasn't coming off the back of two defeats ourselves. So, I mean, I'm licking my lips to some degree, but I'm also cautious that, you know, this time next week, you know, week in football is a long time and Spurs could turn up and do what they do on the weekend. But I think the game is really, really important in terms of both teams' top four. I personally think if Spurs win the game on the weekend, I think we're in trouble in terms of getting that top four spot. I think we fall then behind United, who I know are awful at the moment, but I still feel they can shoot their way to fourth. I think we then fall behind Spurs and United. I think it's a massive game. Look, if you offered Arsenal two draws against Liverpool tonight, at the point of recording, and on the weekend, I'll take two draws. But for Spurs, they need to desperately win on the weekend as well. Just one quick thing about the wing-backs. I find what Spurs are doing with the wing-backs interesting because they're not doing anything. I watched the game yesterday and, you know, they've got a couple of decent-ish wing-backs. And considering Conte does love wing-backs, I find their participation in the game really weird because they're not doing anything going forward or defensively. So either change the system or change the personnel. But I just think for something that's so integral to Conte's way of playing, I watched them over both legs and they're just not doing anything, which I think for a team that relies on its wing back so much, I found that quite interesting as well.
Tommy says, who's shitter at crossing? Tottenham's previous right wing back, Serge Aurier, Tottenham's current right wing back, Emerson Royal, or Tottenham's next right wing back, Adama Traore? And you're like, just somebody who could put the ball in the right place would be a delight. Sorry, Chris. I was just going to say,
I think Jordan's point's a good one. I do wonder whether sort of playing Matt Doherty at left wing back, is a point being made about recruitment again, because actually he's so right footed. It's almost like I felt embarrassed for him a couple of times yesterday because he just can't do anything apart from cut inside. And when you're that predictable, it's really easy to sort of marshal him. And that's just not the first time he's played at left wing back. And so it just made me wonder whether, again, you know, that and Gallini, I did think were just kind of points about recruitment. I mean, for me, I don't really speak Italian, but my translation of Gallini and goal yesterday was, this is what will happen if you don't give Lloris a proper deal.
Yeah. Barry, moving on from your ability to score that goal Thiago scored, you said in the minute by minute that Thomas Tuchel could have brought you on as a sub and Chelsea still would have won. And I think you might be right.
Well, he brought Kante and Thiago Silva on with 15 minutes to go and they've just recovered from COVID. So this was their first tentative steps back. I think they'd only had one training session each. And I'm not long recovered from COVID either. And yeah, I think I could have gone on, played 15 minutes and not adversely affected the result for Chelsea.
We're not that bad.
can we talk about...
I know you know.
Can we talk about the Retire the Chant campaign, Chris? Obviously, this sort of Chelsea rent boy chant that has been directed at Conor Gallagher, from Leeds fans, Liverpool fans, at Billy Gilmore. It was heard at Conor Gallagher in the FA Cup as well. And Spurs fans have said it as well at Chelsea fans. Explain, I mean, it seems pretty obvious to me, but, you know, retiring a chant is quite a difficult thing to do when a chant is embedded within a fan base, right? We've discussed the Y word as well in a different sense, but explain sort of what the campaign is and what you're trying to do.
Well, I think... The first thing is that there's plenty of things you can level at Chelsea. It doesn't have to be that. And I think that it is a homophobic chant. And one of the things that we've been doing for a long time, and it's a big sort of shout out to Tracy Brown from Chelsea Pride as well, is to try and move the CPS on that. Now, that for me, it's not about wanting to criminalise anybody. However, at least if the CPS can say, yes, this is a homophobic slur, we don't have to have that debate all the time, because there's a constant debate of like, why is it homophobic? And, you know, there are a couple of, there's one urban myth about why it's homophobic, and another thing, which is probably where it's actually come from. The urban myth is that there was a Chelsea headhunter in the 80s who was found in bed with another man. But actually, more likely is in the 60s, Chelsea was a sort of a place in the swinging 60s where lots of people went to kind of, you know, find their fortunes, including lots of young gay men who'd been ostracised from their homes for being gay and were often homeless or trying to sort of find a community and found themselves turning to sex work. And that's where that's come from in that sense. However, why would you use a term like that? You'd use a term like that because you know that you're leveling something homophobic. And we and I think it's sort of bad faith to suggest it's anything else. It feels very similar to the we're booing the knee because we don't like Marxism. I don't know how, I've never heard any conversations about Marxism in my in any football ground. And it's, I think this feels kind of the same. It's like, oh, it's not that, it's something else. It's like, no, if it wasn't that, you wouldn't really bother. And I think it's positive to see the CPS make this clear statement because, and as I say, Tracy and I, we got sort of loads, we got a load of impact statements from fans across the board detailing how it feels to hear that, particularly if you're a gay man. And, you know, if you go on across all the Proud Lily White social media, Lee Johnson, my co-chair, was kind of shared his story, actually. And he went to a Spurs-Chelsea match a number of years ago now, and heard that chant, and it was a chant that was levelled at him when he was at school by the school bully. And actually, it really sort of detrimentally affected him, his sense of his self-esteem, his mental health, etc. The school bully was suspended, yet we get all of this all the time in football grounds. And it took Lee 6 years to go back to football. Now, he's not going to be the only one. And for me, and I say this all the time, it's like, I love football. I love walking up those stairs. I love that collective. I love the fact that we're having silly conversations here that you get from, you could go from football to Baz eating pork scratchings. You know, that's what it's all about, right? And that fear of the, and that feeling of the collective, that, you know, like you don't get that in any other way where you've got 60,000 people who all take an intake of breath at the same time. It's magnificent. But I don't want to deny that to anybody. And the fact is that this chant, particularly in the numbers that it comes in, is something that is doing that. And I don't know what the impact is in terms of sheer numbers, because we can't measure it. I don't know who's staying away. I don't know who's left. But if we can retire it, then we're going some way to sort of making the point that saying football really is for everyone and a welcoming environment. And as you say, Max, it is hard, it's a hard thing to do. But we've had support from, you know, Spurs fans all over the world, fans of other football clubs, and loads and loads and loads of kind of straight and cis allies, if you like. It's like, it's not just LGBTQ plus fans saying this affects us. It's others saying, do you know what? I didn't realise that. Because I'm not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that everybody that uses it is using it in a homophobic way. Of course not. But
sure.
I'm hoping that by having this conversation, you're listening and going, do you know what? I could call Chelsea something else.
Do you think this chant is a kind of outlier? And, you know, it's sort of one that has slipped through the net amidst actually a much more open and welcoming football environment? Or do you think actually there is still lots and lots of homophobia, be it sort of very, what's the right way of articulating this, malicious or casual? I mean, they're both malicious, but you see my point.
Sure. I think, weirdly, it's both. Because I think what we've got is we've got an environment in which homophobia is less acceptable. However, you still have it. In the same way that with any other sort of forms of discrimination, is that, yes, we know that broadly it's unacceptable and, you know, people won't do it, but it still happens. But I also think that since coming back to football post-pandemic, you know, since the sort of behind closed doors, people are much more angry. People are cross in football grounds. Maybe it's the pandemic. Maybe it's just the polarisation that we've, that the country just seems to find itself in, whether it's Brexit or the pandemic. And people are really, really cross. And the lines are being drawn of like, who wants to just sort of say, this is my game and I'm not going to change anything. And for me, this isn't about criminalising anybody. It's not about sanitising the game. I think if you want to kind of yell at Chelsea, you don't have to do it in a homophobic way. In the same way that they yell at us, it doesn't have to be in an anti-Semitic way. But it's not about criminalising anyone from my perspective. It's like, what I want to do is have these conversations and actually try to retire the chant rather than, you know, eject people from football stadia.
I was at that that Norwich Liverpool game in August with the chants at Billy Gilmour, which were very bad and very audible as well. But I was really impressed. It was a week or two later when Jurgen Klopp gave a video on the Liverpool website, and forgive me if I got it wrong. I think it's Cop Outs, the LGBTQ plus organization of Liverpool fans, and he was speaking, and it was a decent sized conversation, 10 minutes or so, with a representative from that organization about why the chant was so wrong and what needed to be done about it. And I came away feeling, you know, very impressed and very heartened, and that's not the first time or the last that Jurgen Klopp has been one of the few people in football to maybe stick their head above a parapet on an important topic like that. Would it help, do you think, Chris, if more people in the game followed his lead?
Absolutely. We were all really impressed with that after that, because, you know, Klopp is such a sort of an important figure for Liverpool fans. To have him sort of have talking about anything, you know, they're really up for listening. And actually had a great conversation with Paul Lemann, who chairs Cop Outs. And actually they, you know, and they got into depth, as you say, it wasn't only a few minutes. And that's what we want to see, that you want to see, you know, figures in football clubs having these conversations so we can move on from it.
And actually it's interesting you talk about Klopp sort of speaking out so well. In Australia, Josh Cavallo, who's like the first openly gay male footballer in a top flight anywhere, he was verbally abused during Adelaide United's draw against Melbourne Victory in the A-League on Saturday. He came out and made a statement saying, look, it shouldn't be acceptable. We need to do more to hold these people accountable. Hate will never win. I will never apologise for living my truth, and most recently who I am outside of football. But it shouldn't be down to him, Chris, should it? I mean, like, fine, he could make those statements, but it should be for everyone else around him. It should be for his teammate, his club, the opposition fans, and everybody. You know, I know we've talked about this before, but it's about everybody calling it out, not just expecting the gay people to call it out. I mean, that isn't the point of this.
It's exactly right. And I did think that when I saw Josh's statement, which, of course, he was going to say something, because if you're being subjected to that, you are going to come out and say something. But, you know, I would expect to see it from his teammates. I don't know if the club said anything, you know, exactly that, from the manager, from the opposition, etc. You want to see sort of rallying around it. And I think, you know, from the Liverpool perspective, I thought that was a really good piece of work from them to say, OK, who's the most influential figure in our club? Jurgen Klopp. Let's have a conversation. And that's exactly it. Because, you know, if it wasn't Jurgen Klopp and actually they needed Jordan Henderson to do it, or actually the best thing to do was to have a conversation with Trent Alexander-Arnold, then great. But that's the thing you need to do. Do your analysis. And so if you are Josh Cavallo, that's the other thing. If you're Josh Cavallo's manager, you should be thinking, right, how do I, you know, you've got a duty of care to your player, but also how do you get the best out of your player? And to get the best out of your player to ensure that he continues to perform at his highest is to show him sort of that support and that the team are with him. So, yeah, of course you want to see all of that, both for him and for the cause, in inverted commas.
All right, that'll do for part one. Liverpool Arsenal tonight, by the way, in the Carabao. So we'll look back at that on Monday along with the rest of the Premier League games. Chris, we'll let you go to lick your wounds, and good luck in the North London Derby on Sunday.
Thanks, guys. See you later.
Chris Parros there, Spurs fan from the proud Lily Whites. And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the London Stadium. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jeff says, Max and pod members, is there anyone playing better than Jarrod Bowen? He was sensational against Norwich, but receives little acclaim. In his final season at Hull, he was voted Player of the Year, Players Player of the Year, Supporters Player of the Year, and he's English. You were there, Nick, to watch the Jarrod Bowen show.
I was there, and I walked into the stadium to my seat before the game, and the PA announcer had just got the teams and was leading them out. And he shouted, England's finest, Jarrod Bowen. And I was like, whoa, hold on, what have I walked into here? To be fair, a couple of hours later, it was hard to argue. He scored both goals, but from the first minute of that game, he was absolutely everywhere. He was coming in from the right, as he does. He missed a reasonably good chance after 2 minutes. He kept making darts inside an admittedly quite fragile Norwich defence and trying to find space very intelligently inside, and eventually got his goal with a neat header. And then in the second half, he kept coming. He hit the bar and the foot of a post in a space of about 5 minutes, had a couple of other efforts, and then he had another goal at the end with a nice flick that was disallowed but then correctly given after a VAR review. And I wrote very glowingly about him in my match report because I was very, very impressed. He was constantly seeking weaknesses. Like, he didn't stop all night. He really didn't. And I went downstairs and David Moyes said, oh, I didn't think he played very well first half. And I was like, well, that's why you're in your seat and I'm in mine, isn't it? But it was an outstanding performance. I think he's now got 16 goal involvements this season, which translates into 8 goals and 8 assists. And I think that's more than any other English player at a Premier League club has managed. Now, that's across all competitions, and West Ham, to be fair, play quite a lot of games. But he's on fantastic form, and I don't think he's ever been necessarily a regular clinical finisher, but I think he's someone who shows up. And he's always looking for those opportunities, looking for those space. And I think what you get with Jarrod Bowen in a game, from the ones I've covered, is that he's always in it, always involved, always trying to find those chances. And yesterday, like I say, he really didn't stop. And, you know, the asterisk against anything involving Norwich is that they're really not very good. What identity remained at the end of Daniel Farke's reign is completely gone now, sadly, under Dean Smith, who I think is on a hiding to nothing and really like. But they had nothing last night. They had one really good shot from Adam Eder that Lucas Fabianski tipped onto a post that might have equalised. But apart from that, they were overwhelmed from probably the 20th minute onwards, and it could have been 3-0 or 4-0 or 5-0. But yeah, it was the Jarrod Bowen show. And West Ham, after that wobble they had in December, when I think on Boxing Day we might have thought they were falling away, had their injury crisis, it's them who's now got that fourth spot. I know there are games in hand for Spurs, Arsenal, others, but they've got that position with a lot of games still to play. And I think David Moyes would have taken that a month ago, definitely.
I think the Jarrod Bowen discussion, or for England discussion, is interesting because I'm not one of those fans or members of the media that necessarily subscribes to the idea that if you're having a really good season and you're really on form, that should necessarily equate to an England call-up or a national call-up. I think if you change your national team on the basis of form, you'll be changing your squads every quarter. So, and you have to have some level of consistency. Kane's an example of someone that's not having a very good season, but you would never drop Harry Kane because you know what he's done in the past, you know what he can do for England. However, with Jarrod Bowen, I actually would consider calling him up on the basis of his form this season. One, because I think the alternatives to Harry Kane at England level are not great. Dominic Calvert-Lewin has been out for most of the season. Marcus Rashford through the middle is not really prolific for me. He's not having a great season either. And I think Jarrod Bowen, I think, could be the next one. Danny Ings is not having a great season as well. So he's not putting his hand in the ring either. And I think Bowen, I've watched him a lot this season. I'm really impressed with his movement, his technical ability. I think he's a really good player. And something else I think, just as a bit of a wild point possibly for England in regards to Jarrod Bowen, is because Harry Kane isn't having a great season, if we get to the World Cup this year and he's still not having a very good calendar year, I don't know why we don't consider the idea of doing what Pep Guardiola does with Manchester City, with England, with a very fluid front three of trying a system that has the likes of Sterling, Foden, Jared Bowen, whoever else, almost playing like a, I don't know, false nine, no nine type situation. You've got Foden and Sterling that do it at club level. I think that's something that's a plan B that should be considered, because the striking options at the moment for England aren't looking particularly great, you know, bar Jared Bowen.
I mean, I suppose the interesting question from my point of view, Baz, is, you know, what hasn't he got that those other players that he would be competing with have, apart from a less fashionable CV of Hull, West Ham? And forgive me, I don't know where he was before Hull, if he was anyway.
Well, at the moment, he has everything they have and more, because the players he would be contesting a squad place with are all having pretty poor seasons. You know, we're talking Rashford, Sancho, Grealish, Mason Greenwood, Raheem Sterling, none of whom are having particularly good seasons. I suppose I'm a huge Bowen fan, but the one criticism you could possibly level at him, if you wanted to be particularly nitpicky, is that, you know, his two best games this season, as far as I know, have come against Norwich and Watford. Is he a flat track bully? I don't think so, but you could make that case, maybe. And also, Gareth Southgate tends to be loyal to players who are already in the squad, but I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that he has spoken to David Moyes about Jared Bowen and is definitely considering him for selection. It would be interesting if he does get selected, who would make way for him if everyone in contention for that place is fit.
One more on this game, which is, I don't know if you saw Tim Krul sort of pulling the eyes out of Nikola Vlasic. It looked like, Stamper says, what level of physical assault do the laws of the game allow keepers to get away with? It's quite ridiculous, isn't it?
I don't think it even went to a VAR review. In the stadium, we all had to do a kind of quadruple take, because Krul had ended up in the back of his net, basically, and this corner had gone in. And play carried on, and I think it was Dawson or Soufal who had a shot deflected wide, and then Krul raced out and had a go at the ref, and he thought, oh, okay, well, he's clearly been badly blocked off by Vlasic, the West Ham player. But you look at a couple of replays, and basically Vlasic has just been standing there in a sort of kind of blocking manoeuvre, but not doing much wrong, and Krul has just grabbed him, as far as I could tell, by the neck and hauled him down, and absolutely nothing given, no review. I mean, that was, to me, as clear a penalty as you would ever see. It was absolutely astonishing.
Any mindless transfer gossip doing the round, Nick? You sort of cover Arsenal. Are they going to get Vlahovic?
Oh, I don't want to hear that name ever again. He's doing the rounds day in, day out. And I mean, as somebody who covers them professionally, I would love them to get him because he's fantastic. He's an outstanding all-round centre forward, 21 years old, scoring a lot of goals in Serie A, will only get better. But it's going to be a difficult deal, this. I think it would suit Fiorentina, his current club, to get a good deal done this month if they can, because his contract is ticking down. He's not going to sign a new one. It expires in 2023. Obviously, his worth will presumably be less in the summer. So I think Fiorentina wouldn't mind getting a nice, healthy deal done. And Arsenal, I think, would pay the money that they want. Arsenal, as we found out again in the summer, have cash to spend on the right players. But there's a lot of different considerations. I think Vlahovic wants Champions League football. Does he know at this point if Arsenal can provide it? Do any of us know that? No, we don't. Will we know in the summer? Yes. And there's also, I think, quite a long and complicated situation with what his representatives may or may not want or have wanted from the deal. There's definitely quite a lot of steps to go through on that front. So the answer to your question is I haven't got a clue whether they're signing Vlahovic.
Fine. I mean, no one knows, do they? It's just important to do a bit of mindless transfer chat during the window, just a couple of minutes. The most fun rumour at the moment, Barry, is Jose Mourinho interested in Tanguy Ndombele. I know we've mentioned him before, but that seems surprising. they didn't seem to get on amazingly well at the last place, did they? But anyway, we will see.
I wasn't aware of that, and not a huge amount Jose Mourinho does or is interested in would surprise me these days.
Anyway, that'll do. They had a very interesting game against Juve. Blew a two-goal lead in 7 minutes, had a late penalty saved to go level. We've got a Europod next week, so we'll go in-depth into Serie A and all the others. Shameless Twitch says, what does the panel think of Lorenzo Insigne signing with Toronto FC and what it means for MLS? Barry?
Well, on the face of it, it's very surprising, you know, this Italian superstar leaving Napoli after 16 years. But commercially, it makes a lot of sense for both him and Toronto FC. He's going to be paid £11 million a year for 4 years. And Toronto, as I'm sure you know, Max, have the fourth largest population of Italian immigrants or descendants of Italian immigrants in the world.
So New York is ahead third of them, I presume. Ooh.
Go South America for the other two.
All right, Buenos Aires.
Correct, second.
And they're more in Brazil than Argentina, I'm surprised.
A Brazilian city, yeah.
Sao Paulo.
Correct, very good.
Thank you so much. What do I win?
You win my respect for the next 10 minutes.
If this was turnabout, I've got 20 points just then.
So yeah, there's over 500,000 Italian Canadians in Toronto. So they, I'm sure, will be interested in going to see him play. And the boss man at Toronto, whose name I can't remember, the sort of chief exec or head of recruitment, the way he identified Insigne as a potential signing was he went on transfermarket.com, the website that's as handy as a small pot. I use it regularly every day, and I believe it's very popular with the kids who play Football Manager, not a game I've ever gotten interested in, despite the best attempts of my old pal Ian McIntosh. He went on Transfer Market to see which Italian stars were coming out of contract. And that's how he identified Insigne as a potential transfer, got in touch with his people, and a deal was agreed, which I think, while on the face of it makes no sense whatsoever, if you dig a little deeper, makes loads of sense for both parties.
They've got some form for that to them, haven't they? Because they got Sebastian Giovinco. Apologies if my pronunciation is all over the place. When he was still a player at Juventus and I think a serving Italy international in around 2015, he went there, if I'm not wrong, and was sort of widely seen a few years later as the best MLS player of all time. Maybe Insigne has seen that and seen that he's got boots to fill, although that did, I think, end Giovinco's Italy career.
To the best of my knowledge, Jozy Altidore is at Toronto, so maybe they wanted the pair of them to link up and score lots and lots of goals.
Perhaps Lorenzo heard that Jozy was your favourite American US soccer player, and for that reason, that's why Insigne went.
Well, Toronto also have form for signing shit Sunderland has-beens, because I think Daniel Dicchio went there after he left Sunderland. So that was probably in a bid to appease the local Italian expat community as well.
Is there a longer list in football than shit Sunderland has been? I'm not sure there is. That'll do for part two. Part three will begin with AFCON. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about the Africa Cup of Nations, of which there is one big story from the Tunisia-Mali match. D asks, does AFCON have an official timing partner? Rich says, how long is it before the referee in the Tunisia-Mali match gets invited to serve as the VAR for the North London derby? And Han says, what plans could you possibly have to make you blow the whistle after 85 minutes and then reluctantly starting the game again, ending it with no extra minutes after 89 minutes and 47 seconds? It is, Jordan, hilarious, isn't it? I mean, unless, of course, you're the Tunisia management team, who are presumably still running around the pitch in absolute rage about this.
Well, I can completely understand why people would find this hilarious and why people have been laughing at it, because on the face of it, this is really comical. Like, to mess up once is embarrassing. A second time is just like something needs to be looked into there. But it's actually, I think, a really bad look in all seriousness, because I don't know how you even explain that. I don't know how you accidentally twice end a game early. And, you know, there was a couple of games that was one game I watched where there was the game had to be stopped, I think, two or three times to blow up balls. You know, the lack of supporters. And I've been to the continent in four times in the last 2 years. I think I've been to seven countries. And one of the things I've been coming back telling people is how football mad Africans are. Like, we think it's crazy over here in the UK. In Africa, it's like a religion. And then people are saying to me, now, well, where are they? Because they're watching the games and there's nobody there. I think there is a cost problem as to why the stadiums are so empty. But I think this kind of typified a really, really bad first week for AFCON. It's a, you know, again, there was a lot of talk about the disrespect of African football from the West, from many managers and much of the media. But it's very difficult. And I was there was no one out there defending African football more than me. And I think at a time when so many African footballers are so prolific in the world game, this was something I was looking forward to. And I wanted everyone else to look forward to. But when you have incidents like this, I just think it's very easy to laugh it off. But I think it really damages African football and the players and the supporters. It's not really cool. And I think this needs to be looked into. The level of referee, and I think, has been shocking. So it's all in all been, I think, a really poor start for AFCON in that sense.
I mean, do you think that, you know, because what you want to do is, if you treat a tournament with respect, you treat it in the same way that you would any other tournament. And if that happened in any other tournament, I would find it hilarious, right? If it was the Euros or the World Cup, I totally understand your point. I suppose it's coming from a point of, I want to find that funny because it is funny. I mean, it's also embarrassing at the same time. Like, it's totally, both of those
totally,
things.
Totally, no, it's 100%. And I think that the reason why I think African football needs to look introspectively and look at itself, and it's all well and good, you know, defending its tournament against the West and those that are kind of mocking it and disrespecting it. Well, okay, now we're all watching the tournament. The pressure's now on you guys to deliver a tournament of a certain standard. They need to look internally in terms of how they are conducting their own tournament. I think there are reasons I won't go into on the pod here as to why I think it's been as poor as it has been. But I think overall they need to do better, because it's going to be a laughingstock. And there'll be a time, and I think there are instances in the past whereby African footballers have not wanted to go back and play in certain tournaments because the organisation has been so poorly. If this continues, I think that will happen on a larger scale. You'll get some of the top players refusing to go back in future, not because they don't want to play for their country, they just don't want to be part of a laughingstock that I think that this AFCON tournament has the possibility of turning into.
Yeah, it was a really strange event. There's been a few suggestions that maybe he had heat stroke a bit, because it was very, very hot, and he might have been dizzy and sort of lost control of looking at his watch. That's something I heard last night. There's other suggestions that I think there'd been a drinks break, hadn't there, a few minutes before, and he might have let his watch run on. He certainly had a very eventful half for referee. He'd given two penalties for handball that probably weren't, and then he'd sent off, after his first attempt to blow for full time, he'd sent off a Mali player for something that wasn't even a booking, and then doubled down after VAR. So it had been a fairly confused performance all round. And yeah, I do think, sort of, to Jordan's point, it's a shame that this ends up being what people talk about where AFCON is concerned, because it is such a fantastic tournament. I mean, I'm going out there to Cameroon next Thursday to cover the knockouts. Part of me thinks, well, look, this is just someone messing up somewhere. Doesn't matter where on the planet they did it. You know, we had an English referee show three yellow cards at a World Cup once, you know. And so I don't think we should be singling out the AFCON for the ridicule that I've seen it receiving in some places in the last 24 hours or so. But there is that perception issue that has lingered for a while due to various things which have happened before and various disorganisation. And I don't think this helps it. And I think there was a lot of high hopes going into this tournament that it was going to be a bit smoother running. It's not a particularly great thing at all that FIFA have been taking over a lot of CAF, the Confederation of African Football's running in a fairly colonial way, one has to say. But a lot of the media accreditation and stuff before the tournament, for example, ran very, very smoothly. And you thought, OK, for better or for worse, is this tournament going to be quite smooth? But early on, it's been patchy. The quality of football has not been brilliant. The crowds, Jordan's right. Cameroon does have quite a match-going culture, I think, we've seen in the past. But the stadiums have been nearly empty apart from the host nation. I think that might partly be because you need to have a PCR test and be vaccinated before going in to a game at this AFCON. And frankly, a very low proportion, unfortunately, of the Cameroonian population are vaccinated. It's something like 2 or 3%. So that will not be helping. But that's what people are seeing on their TV screens. And the sad thing is that they won't necessarily be interrogating the reasons why these things are happening.
Interestingly, the CAF official highlights reel on YouTube of this game didn't show the scenes at the end, just completely ignored them. And if nothing else, this story also covered up the fact that Mali's last training session before this game had to be brought to an abrupt halt because there was a gun battle going on nearby between separatists and government forces. That's possibly more alarming than a referee making a mistake, bringing a match to a premature halt.
I think it is really interesting. I think what you want to do is you want to judge things as they happen, don't you? And I guess the point is if you treat the tournament with respect before and you cover it well, and you know, The Guardian, we send people to it, then you can be in a place when a referee does something ridiculous, say that referee did something ridiculous, like we would with the Premier League and Mike Dean doing something ridiculous. If all you do is retweet that and go, AFCON, I've done it, then that is disrespectful. I guess that's how I feel about it.
I've also learned about the existence of another country, which is Mauritania, who's okay. In another era yesterday. They were lining up for their game against Gambia, which they lost 1-0. Every game, I think, except the first one, has finished 0-0 or 1-0. The wrong national anthem was played twice, and then they were asked to sing it without music instead, and their players were decidedly unhappy with that. But Mauritania sounds like one of those made-up countries that Melchester Rovers used to go and play European Cup ties in. Back, you know, in Roy the Rovers back in the 80s. So I had to Google that one as well.
You learned anything about it?
Not a huge amount. I think it's another sort of island on the... Or no, it's on the west coast of Africa, sandwiched between...
Nick is desperately trying to jump
go
in.
Go on, so Nick.
Can you confer?
No, I'm letting Baz do this.
Premier League is back this weekend. Some really good games actually coming up. Manchester City, Chelsea, 12:30 kickoff. You sort of presume Chelsea, Jordan, have to win this one, otherwise the Premier League, which is already over, will really be over.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the result's going to have any bearing on the Premier League winners personally, but I think now Chelsea and Liverpool are battling for second spot. And I think the second spot for both those managers and both those clubs is important. I think they would like to get second spot. And I think also from a Liverpool perspective, the team they play tonight, I think will show how important they want to try and get momentum for back in the lead to try and get that second spot as well. So I think Chelsea will lose. I just think Man City are in the groove now. I think they want to get the title wrapped up as soon as possible so they can try and focus on the Champions League. But yeah, hopefully it'll be a good game.
And Newcastle Watford, Barry, would Newcastle losing this one be a bigger shock than their defeat at the weekend?
I wouldn't be a shock. I mean, Newcastle losing any game isn't a shock. They have wrapped up the signing of Chris Wood. There is debate raging on social media over whether it's a good signing or a bad signing. At the moment, it's a good signing. They wanted him. They got him. That's good. Whether or not he will score any goals remains to be seen. So we can't really judge whether it's a good signing until the end of the season, when we find out what division Newcastle are going to be playing in next season.
It's a really good signing, the Chris Wood one. I don't know what people are on about. It's because he's a slightly, you know, big, leading the line, not that glamorous 30-year-old. But for four straight seasons now, he's got double figures plus in some of them in the Premier League. All right, he's got, I think, three this season, but Burnley have been wall-to-wall pretty terrible. You know, that how many strikers have done that? How many Premier League centre-forwards outside of your really massive ones have got a record like that? I'm playing for Burnley, who are not very creative. So I think a 20 to 25 million, whatever it was, fee for Chris Wood in January... In your relegation battle, I've seen people kicking off on social media. What are they talking about? It's a great transfer. It's a fantastic deal.
Well, you don't know that until you see how he gets on. As I said, it's good in that they wanted him and they got him. That's the only reason it's a good transfer at the moment. He may be absolute dog shit. We don't know. He might get injured in his first game and be out for the rest of the season. Would that make him a good transfer? No.
That would make him a bad transfer, but I'm judging it by the logic. Assuming Newcastle's new owners have some logic, at which it was carried out, and some of that logic may have been to neuter Burnley. They might be that cynical. Burnley obviously now they haven't got Maxwell Cornet because he's at AFCON, and now they haven't got Chris Wood ever again, and that's probably their two biggest threats. Out of the game, and they obviously play Leicester at the weekend in the Chris Wood doesn't play for you anymore derby, which is a very big game for them now.
I think it's more sensible than a good signing, really. It's not a glamorous one. You know, he's good in the air. They've got Trippier, who's a good deliverer of the ball. If Chris Wood, between now and the end of the season, can get them 8 goals, that gives them a chance. I think Newcastle will go down regardless, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this wouldn't have been a good transfer, in my view, if that makes sense.
Interestingly, there are reports that Burnley are furious with Newcastle for triggering this release clause in his contract. But Simon Jordan said on the radio yesterday, I don't know if this is true or not, but he claimed that the transfer or the release clause in his contract only applied to transfers conducted during the summer. So if he's right, and that is the case, what does that say about Burnley's decision to sell him?
It's a very good point. Norwich-Everton is interesting in case Everton don't get a win from that one. Villa play Manchester United. Pete says, does Barry do the Ronaldo sue weird thing at least 100 times a day? This is Manchester United's social media who tweeted, you know, after a scratchy 1-0 win over Aston Villa, who else sues 100 times? Is it just sue? Sue? Who else sues 100 times a day? Laughing emoji. Pointing an arrow down. I mean, very sort of, I mean, I know maybe social media isn't for us. I'm aware that, you know, this is, you know, none of us are young anymore. But it just seems a very odd move from your football club.
The thing, Max, I think it was an embarrassing tweet because, and I thought what you just said, though, I thought, okay, maybe this is not targeted at me. And I thought, well, who is it targeted at? Because if it's at a younger demographic, young kids aren't generally on Twitter. And even if they are, it still doesn't. It's still not a tweet that makes any sense. Like I just thought I cringed when you put it in the group. I cringed. Yeah,
it's hard to do anything 100 times a day, isn't it? I mean, that's a lot of your day to just do that. I mean, I'm sure some kids are doing it.
It's an awful celebration as well. It's a really rubbish celebration, but that's just me.
Well, it's not for me, but you know, each to their own, I guess. Liverpool, Brentford, West Ham, Leeds, Spurs, Arsenal is a reasonably fun Sunday. We'll finish with this from Bill Werbeneck, who is not the actual snooker player, who I believe is no longer with us. After having worked his magic on Iheanacho and Ayo recently, I'd love it if Baz could slag off my daughter Beth, who's playing in the Sussex Under-14s County Cup final this weekend. Give it your best, Baz.
Well, the thing with Beth is she doesn't put in the effort at training. Her link-up play is poor. She's selfish. not far from clinical in front of goal. And I think she'd be very lucky to even get selected for this Sussex final. But if she does get a game, I would expect very little from her because I'm not a fan of Beth and I don't see her having a future in the game.
Well, there we are. Bill, let us know how that goes. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome. And good luck, Beth.
We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.